content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the January 18th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows three of the new congresswomen, newly elected congresswomen, standing on the steps of the Capitol. All three are young women of color. I know one of them is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but to be honest, I don't recognize the other two. But they're smiling and they're taking a selfie. And the title is A New Era in Congress. Can the Democrats' newcomers succeed in changing Washington? And that will be one of the main stories, but we'll start with the other, which is President Trump's sales pitch for a border wall. What happened? President Trump this week pressed his case for a border wall in his first ever nationally televised primetime Oval Office address, hoping to rally public support in a funding fight that has shut down parts of the government for more than 2 weeks. In a 9-minute speech, Trump depicted the situation at the southern border in dire terms, calling it a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs and describing several recent murders of American citizens by illegal immigrants. Trump called on the Democrats to accept his demand for $5.7 billion to start adding more than 200 miles of additional steel barriers to the existing 654 miles of fencing and nearly $1 billion more to improve conditions for the thousands of migrant families being held in custody. My administration is doing everything in our power to help those impacted by the situation, Trump said. But the only solution is for Democrats to pass a spending bill that defends our borders and reopens the government. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, appearing alongside Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in the Democrats' televised response, accused Trump of manufacturing a crisis. Pelosi emphasized that House Democrats have already passed a bill to reopen the government, the same bill that unanimously passed the Republican-controlled Senate during the last Congress in December. That bill contained $1.3 billion for border security, including enhanced surveillance technology, but nothing for new barriers. Mr. President, reopen the government and we can work to resolve our differences on border security, Schumer said, accusing the president of governing by temper tantrum. Meanwhile, the consequences of the shutdown mounted, including long lines at airports affected by TSA agents calling in sick to protest working without pay. And there were signs that Republican support for the shutdown is wavering. Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Cory Gardner of Colorado and several House Republicans called for the government to be reopened while the debate over the border continues. What the editorial said. How ironic that President Trump's first Oval Office address was in response to a crisis of his own making, said the New York Times. Roughly a quarter of the federal government is shut down because Trump insists on funding for a ludicrous border wall. This will do nothing to deter the flood of desperate Central American asylum seekers or to end the overcrowding and needless suffering and deaths caused by the White House's mass detention policies. But Trump promised his supporters a wall, so he is using this self-inflicted tragedy as a justification for pursuing more wasteful, hardline measures that most Americans do not support. Trump doesn't help his cause when he exaggerates, misrepresents, and misunderstands the facts, said the Washington Examiner. For example, it's not true that illegal drugs are flowing over unprotected sections of the border. The vast majority are smuggled through official border crossings in cars and trucks. But Trump isn't trying to manufacture a crisis. There are already more than 10 million illegal immigrants living in the country as a result of our porous borders, a fact that undermines the rule of law. Better physical barriers would help. Once we accept that basic truth, we can have a better debate. What the columnist said. If the wall is really answer to our border problems, asked Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, why didn't Trump start seriously pushing for one until now? Republicans enjoyed unified control of the White House and Congress for 2 years, but did little to secure wall funding. Trump decided a wall was critical only after conservative pundits like Ann Coulter began mocking him for not delivering on his signature promise, triggering his fear that his base will desert him in 2020. The U.S. doesn't have a border crisis. Trump's campaign does. The media won't report this, but Trump's proposal goes beyond a wall, said Molly Hemingway in The Federalist. In addition to 234 more miles of fencing, President Trump called for 52,000 extra detention beds to ease overcrowding and $800 million to improve care for families at the border. Aren't those things Democrats claim to care about? Asked Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. It should be easy for the president and Dems to cut a split-the-difference deal and move on to the next problem. But Democratic leaders are dead set against giving Trump anything resembling a victory out of bitterness and hatred for a president who won an election fair and square. There is a real immigration problem on the border, said David Frum in The Atlantic. But barriers won't stop the influx of thousands of Central American families with children who are showing up and applying for asylum. It can be solved only by hiring more judges to hear asylum cases and quickly dispatch the majority who do not qualify back to their home countries. But Trump has never wanted a solution. He has wanted a divisive issue and a personal monument. And our second main story harkens back to the cover drawing we talked about. A new era of divided government begins. What happened? The 116th Congress was gaveled into order last week, with Democrats taking control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 8 years, and a historically diverse class of Democratic freshmen vowing to challenge President Trump. After being elected as House Speaker for the second time, Nancy Pelosi said that voters had demanded a new dawn in the November midterms and promised that the chamber would work for the people. She said Democrats would use their 36-seat majority to lower health care costs, protect Dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought to America as children, and increase paychecks by rebuilding America with green and modern infrastructure from sea to shining sea. Pelosi also vowed to restore integrity to government, but resisted calls by members of her caucus to begin impeachment proceedings against Trump. Signaling a new era of divided and deadlocked government, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said his chamber, where Republicans hold a 53-47 edge, would not consider any House bills opposed by the president. The swearing-in ceremony for the new Congress included many historic firsts. A record 102 women were seated in the House, 89 of them Democrats, 13 Republicans, and 25 in the Senate. The incoming Democrats include the first two Muslim women, Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, and the first Native American women, Representatives Sharice Davids and Deb Haaland. The new Congress also boasts a record number of Hispanic lawmakers, 45, Asian Americans, 17, and African Americans, 55. What the editorial said. We've got a long way to go before women make up 50% of our legislators, said the Los Angeles Times, but their increase in number is worth celebrating. Studies show women govern more collaboratively than men and are more likely to focus on issues such as health care, child care, and education. A move in those directions would be welcome. Plus, democracy works best when it actually represents all its people, not just a lucky elite. Nobody should expect a new era of progress in Washington, said the Wall Street Journal. Democrats ran on one issue in 2018, rejecting Trump and all his works. So the goal of the new House will be investigating, not legislating. Get set for hearings on everything from Trump's tax returns to his alleged payments to Stormy Daniels, and even Ivanka Trump's and Jared Kushner's email habits. House Democrats will trail every cabinet officer down to whether he ordered a cocktail on a commercial flight. What the columnist said. House Democrats should hold hearings and hold the administration accountable, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. But they have to do it the right way and not chase nutty conspiracy theories as Republicans did under President Barack Obama. Democrats have to be the adults in the room and focus on the main goal of helping the government function properly rather than get carried away with scoring political points. The first day of Congress left me optimistic, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. After 2 years of Trumpian anger, invective, insults, it was a joy to hear Pelosi speak of the need for bipartisanship and praise the idealism and patriotism of this transformative freshman class. I could be wrong, but it felt like the beginning of the end of Trump and Trumpism. Actually, all Democrats did on day one was launch an extreme agenda that's dead on arrival in the GOP-controlled Senate, said Jenna Ellis in WashingtonExaminer.com. They passed a spending bill that would allow taxpayer dollars to once again flow to NGOs that promote or perform abortions overseas, and some Democrats in the House filed impeachment papers. These petulant and childish actions are evidence of the gridlock to come. The new young Democrats will soon realize that control of the House isn't all it's cracked up to be, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. For all their enthusiasm, talk of leftist dream projects like a Green New Deal and Medicare for All, Washington, D.C. still runs on the inescapable reality of power. And with a Republican president and GOP-controlled Senate, Pelosi said her caucus don't really have it. That disconnect leaves Pelosi in the same situation as John Boehner, who became Speaker after the Tea Party election in 2010, and no one envied Boehner. Our controversy of the week, continuing in the same vein of the last article, is titled Ocasio-Cortez, Why So Much Attention? Is it any surprise that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez makes conservatives so mad, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. The 29-year-old former waitress from the Bronx was sworn in only last week for her first term as Democratic Congresswoman, but she's already attracting more breathless scrutiny and criticism from right-wing media than any woman since Hillary Clinton. Among the recent bombshells from Fox News and right-wing Twitter trolls that Ocasio-Cortez went by Sandy in high school, supposedly a betrayal of her Puerto Rican roots, and she attended a high school in a middle-class community in Westchester, not in the Bronx, supposedly invalidating her working-class authenticity. These non-scandals, of course, are all proxies for conservatives' real anxieties. As a charismatic young Latina with distinctively progressive ideas, Ocasio-Cortez embodies a lot of conservative fears about demographic change. They're terrified that in AOC, as she's increasingly known, Democrats have found themselves a cool, intelligent star. Republicans should be scared, said Max Kongsell in The Nation. On 60 Minutes this week, Ocasio-Cortez made a powerful case for what she calls a Green New Deal, a sweeping overhaul of the U.S. economy with major investments in high-tech training, clean energy research, and millions of new jobs that could save the Democratic Party as well as the planet. Nonsense, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. The main reason conservatives are admittedly fixated on Ocasio-Cortez is that in politics, you always need villains. And AOC perfectly fits the bill. Her utopian fantasies, coupled with her wild-eyed delivery, make her seem like the unbridled id of a left-lurching Democratic Party. The more exposure Ocasio-Cortez and her proposals to spend trillions get, conservatives believe, the more likely people are to vote Republican. AOC's Green New Deal isn't just ambitious, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. It's insane. She not only wants to save the planet, but along the way achieve all of socialism, including single-payer health care, free college, and the eradication of poverty, all somehow paid for with a confiscatory 70% tax rate on the wealthy. What's so radical about a 70% marginal tax rate? Asked Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. First of all, she proposes that it kick in only on income over $10 million. It wouldn't apply to the first $9.9 million. That's a far lower top rate than the 91% we had in the 1950s, a period of booming economic growth that many conservatives still consider America's golden age. On taxes, AOC is really just proposing a return to the 20th century norm, said Noah Smith in Bloomberg.com. As recently as 1981, the top tax rate was 69%. Still, her 70% tax rate would increase federal revenues only by 3.6%, not nearly enough revenue to pay for her Green New Deal, let alone Medicare for All. That's why many of us on the left have mixed feelings about AOC's sudden rock star status, said Christopher Dale in the New York Post. Once her pie-in-the-sky agenda meets legislative reality, her young base will have a cold awakening, furthering the millennial malaise that keeps hurting Democrats at the polls. Call her naive if you like, said Nathan Robinson in The Guardian, but her proposals have already ignited a serious national debate over what the top tax rate should be and what the nation should do about climate change. Even when conservatives are fuming about Ocasio-Cortez, they can't stop talking about her ideas. Not bad for her first week of work. Let's see what we've got in our good week, bad week segment. Seems that it was a good week for seamen after the U.S. Navy abolished the age-old right of captains to punish troublemaking sailors by putting them on a diet of bread and water. Veteran Captain Scott Tate said meals are a highlight of the monotonous life at sea, and to take that away from someone is more meaningful than people would think. It was a good week for exhaustion. After the entire Golden Globes awards ceremony in Los Angeles miraculously passed without a single mention of President Trump. Everyone is depressed, said host Andy Samberg. Everyone could use a little time to laugh and celebrate. And it was a good week for getting half after Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and his wife, novelist Mackenzie Bezos, announced they were ending after their 25-year marriage. Bezos is worth an estimated $140 billion, and the couple, who have four children, own five spectacular homes. But it was a bad week for getting a text from your husband. With new regulations in Saudi Arabia, requiring husbands to alert their wives by text message if they decide to divorce them. This ends the secret divorce whereby men can end their marriages without their wives' knowledge. It was a bad week for Representative Frederica Wilson, who still can't wear her trademark sequined cowboy hats in the House of Representatives, despite a rule change allowing lawmakers to wear hats for religious reasons. And it was a bad week for defying age after the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency announced that 90-year-old cyclist Carl Grove of Indiana has failed a drug test and will be stripped of the senior medal he won last July at the U.S. Masters Track National Championship. Grove insists that any banned substances entered his body through contaminated meat. And before we leave this page, we'll read a boring but important item. U.S. CO2 emissions spike upward. U.S. carbon dioxide emissions shot up 3.4% last year, the biggest increase in 8 years, according to a report published this week. The spike, after 3 years of decline, occurred despite a near-record number of coal plants closing last year and growing use of alternative fuel vehicles and renewable power sources. Analysts at the Rhodium Group say the uptick is the result of a surging economy, with a manufacturing boom leading to a 5.7% increase in emissions from industrial sectors. Greenhouse gas emissions peaked at 6 billion metric tons in 2007, just before the start of the Great Recession. The Rhodium report comes in advance of the Environmental Protection Agency's tally of carbon emissions, which won't be released until 2020. And speaking of the EPA, our briefing page article this week is titled Redefining the EPA. Under President Trump, the Environmental Protection Agency has made industry happy and environmentalists angry. What is the EPA's mission? The agency was created by President Richard Nixon in 1970. A time when industrial pollution shrouded cities in smog, turned rivers and lakes into toxic stews of human waste and chemicals, and left shorelines blackened by garbage and oil spills. Through our years of past carelessness, Nixon said, we incurred a debt to nature, and now that debt is being called. He tasked the new agency with protecting Americans' health and the environment. For most of the past half century, Congress and the White House have enacted environmental laws that set out broad policy goals, which the EPA turns into regulations rooted in scientific research. These regulations carry the force of law. Essentially, Congress loans the EPA its constitutional authority to regulate commerce on the assumption that scientists and technically oriented experts are able to make more specific, up-to-date regulations than legislators can. What is Trump's view of the EPA? During the 2016 presidential campaign, Trump decried the EPA as a job-killing bureaucracy that had needlessly hamstrung the American economy with costly regulations. He vowed to get rid of it in almost every form, leaving just little tidbits of environmental regulation. This view was welcomed by many hardline conservatives and, of course, by industry. The American people are drowning in rules and regulations promulgated by unelected bureaucrats, said Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, who was one of the four Republican congressmen who sponsored a 2017 bill that would have abolished the EPA. And the Environmental Protection Agency has become an extraordinary offender. Since his inauguration, Trump has stacked the EPA's senior leadership with officials openly hostile to the agency's original mission. His first EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, had sued the EPA 14 times as Oklahoma's attorney general in behalf of the state's oil industry. The second, Andrew Wheeler, is a former energy industry lobbyist and lawyer. The EPA's senior deputy general counsel worked at the American Petroleum Institute. What has this new EPA done? So far, it has abolished a total of 47 environmental regulations and is in the process of rolling back 31 more, according to the New York Times analysis. A separate analysis by Harvard Law School found that such rollbacks could lead to at least 80,000 additional deaths per decade and cause respiratory problems for more than a million people. To reverse the ongoing decline of the coal industry, Pruitt killed a 2015 rule banning coal-fired electricity plants from dumping 1.4 billion pounds a year of toxic wastewater into rivers and streams, contaminating them with mercury, selenium, and arsenic. These pollutants have been linked to cancer, cardiovascular disease, and neurological disorders. Under Trump, oil and gas companies no longer have to inform the EPA about their methane emissions or leaks, an important regulatory easing, since these companies emit 13 million metric tons of this extremely potent greenhouse gas annually. The EPA also lifted key controls mandating that major factories use the best technology available to reduce air pollutants, including cancer-causing benzene, dioxin, and lead. In April, the EPA said it would no longer enforce a ban on super-polluting hydrofluorocarbons, greenhouse gases 1,000 times more potent than carbon dioxide, in cooling devices such as air conditioners and refrigerators. In early 2017, the EPA reversed an impending ban on the use of chlorpyrifos on crops, despite some evidence that this pesticide can cause developmental problems in children and neurological problems in farm workers. A federal appeals court has ordered the EPA to reinstate that ban. What about carbon emissions? Under both Pruitt and Wheeler, the EPA has acted as if climate change did not exist. It has, in fact, wiped any mention of that term from the agency's website and prohibited its scientists from participating in climate change conferences. In August, the agency proposed to freeze fuel efficiency standards for cars, SUVs, and light trucks at 37 miles per gallon after 2021, a major rollback from the 54 miles per gallon standard by 2025, mandated by the Obama administration. One analysis estimated this policy change would pump into the would more than triple the amount of carbon dioxide that American cars pump into the atmosphere by 2035. The EPA has also moved to hobble President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which sought to lower carbon dioxide emissions from U.S. coal-fired power plants by 32% by 2030. Its proposed replacement plan would reduce emissions by only about 1%. What about enforcement of laws? It's way down. In fiscal 2017, the EPA initiated 20% fewer civil actions against polluters and 30% fewer criminal cases than during the year prior. In 2018, there was a 38% drop in EPA orders requiring polluters to comply with the law, and a 50% drop in the number of fines. The EPA defends its policies, saying it has sought to restore regulatory certainty to the American economy after the reckless overreach of the previous administration. Environmentalists argue that it's the current EPA that has been reckless. The Trump administration, says Marianne Sullivan of the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative, is prioritizing industry's needs and desires over the health of our environment and the health of our communities. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll take two from the U.S. First is Evangelicals' Devotion to a False Idol. When Jerry Falwell Jr. was recently asked if there was anything President Trump could do to lose his evangelical support, his simple answer was no. This tells you why Trump is counting on religious conservative voters for his political survival, said Michael Gerson. While some parts of Trump's coalition have begun to crack under the weight of his chronic lying, vanity, cruelty, and corruption, his evangelical support has solidified into something like devotion. Why? After a century of losing ground to liberal secular culture, evangelicals see that struggle in apocalyptic terms. In their battle with the Philistines, evangelicals have essentially hired their own Goliath, brutal, pagan, but on their side. That deal will have a long-lasting cost. Many women, minorities, and young people have come to associate religious conservatism with Trump's sexism, xenophobia, and racism, further marginalizing Christianity. In the past, Christianity has been used to justify segregation, slavery, and other wrongs. But reformers like William Wilberforce and Martin Luther King have reminded Christians of the faith's fundamental belief in the dignity of all humankind. After Trump, we'll need new reformers to save Christianity from those who've reduced it to a sad and sordid game of thrones. Why 2018 was the best year ever. Everyone knows that the world is going to hell, said Nicholas Kristof. But let me try to make the case that 2018 was actually the best year in human history. It's the nature of the news business to focus on disasters, war, starvation, and environmental threats. But such coverage leaves most people spectacularly misinformed. In polls, 90% of Americans say global poverty is getting worse or not improving. In fact, poverty is rapidly retreating. In the early 1980s, 44% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty, defined as less than $2 per person per day. Now fewer than 10% live in extreme poverty. Every day on average last year, 295,000 people gained electricity for the first time, 305,000 got clean drinking water for the first time, and another 620,000 were hooked up to the internet. Lifespans and literacy are rapidly increasing. It may seem Pollyanna-ish to celebrate these victories, but a failure to acknowledge global progress can leave people feeling hopeless and ready to give up. What has already been accomplished should show us what is possible and help fuel our efforts to make the world a better place. This comes from France. Can Macron defeat the Yellow Vests? The Yellow Vest movement has taken an insurrectionist term, said Timinogue.re in an editorial. What started last November as a protest over tax hikes and diesel gasoline, with demonstrators sporting the reflective vests that French drivers keep in their cars for emergencies, has become a rejection of President Emmanuel Macron's entire agenda. Macron, a political newcomer whose centrist forward movement upended decades of two-party rule, pushed through pro-business reforms, only to find himself deeply unpopular. First, he appeased the Yellow Vests by delaying the fuel tax rise, but when they kept protesting, he sicked the riot police on them. That provoked last week's shocking scenes of violence across France, the worst of it in Paris, where demonstrators commandeered a forklift truck and rammed a government building, sending Macron's spokesman fleeing out the back. A former pro boxer beat up two policemen, a riverboat restaurant on the Seine was set on fire, and the Musée d'Orsay had to close early. The protesters vow to keep going every Saturday until Macron is gone. These leaderless protests won't end because they are all things to all people, said Thomas Legrand in Franceinter.fr. The most violent agitators, of course, are simply anarchists. But many others are angry over Macron policies they fear will push them into poverty, while some fume over what they see as the loss of their Gallic identity. While only 50,000 people joined the protests last week, polls show that more than half the population supports this amorphous uprising. The best way to defuse the unrest, then, is to force the yellow vests into coherence, so they tell us what specifically they want, besides Macron's resignation, which is a non-starter. It's time to make them finally do the basic work, organize, prioritize their claims, and put them up for discussion. Macron has a plan for that, said Alain Auffray and Lilian Alemania in Liberation. He has announced a great debate among the French. Starting next week and continuing until mid-March, town halls will be held across the country and an internet site will be launched where the citizens can propose reforms. Already more than 3,000 municipalities have collected proposals from the residents. We can expect innumerable grievances to be aired. The key questions, though, are first, how will those many complaints be tallied? And what will be done with the results? And second, will the yellow vests even join in? Or will they see any participation in the political process as selling out? Who cares what they want, said Sebastian Lefol in Le Point. You can't negotiate with people who refuse to talk, and the yellow vests rain death threats down on any member of their cohort who deigns to speak to the press. These people want to sow chaos and overthrow the republic. It's time to stop calling them protesters. They are rioters. Macron's debate can happen only after the restoration of order. And it's time for the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, When Kids Think a Shooter is Coming. Lockdowns have become an ordinary feature of the American school day, said journalists Stephen Rich and John Woodrow Cox. Even when there's no violence, children suffer the psychic consequences. Locked behind their green classroom door, Mackenzie Woody and 25 other first graders huddled in the darkness. She sat on the vinyl tile floor against the far wall, beneath a taped-up list of phrases the kids were encouraged to say to each other. I like you. You're a rainbow. Are you okay? In that moment, though, the six-year-old didn't say anything at all, because she believed that a man with a gun was stalking the hallways of her school in the nation's capital, and Mackenzie feared what he might do to her. Three times between September and November, bursts of gunfire near Mackenzie's public charter elementary school led D.C. Prep to seal off its Washington campus and sequester its students. During the last one on November 16th, a silver sedan parked just around the corner at 10:42 a.m., then the men inside stepped out and fired more than 40 rounds. As Mackenzie's class hid upstairs, teachers frantically rushed 36 preschoolers off the playground and back into the building. The children of D.C. Prep hid for 20 minutes until police officers arrived at the crime scene around the corner and began to take note of where the 40-plus bullet casings had scattered. What did not arrive was the caravan of TV trucks and reporters that so often descend on schools when such scenes play out in wider, wealthier neighborhoods. In the hours that followed, students began to unravel. Among the things they said, who's going to shoot me? I want to shoot people. I want to shoot myself. The lockdowns, as Mackenzie calls them, have changed her. Because the little girl with long braids and chocolate brown eyes remembers what it was like before them, when she always felt safe at her school. And she knows what it's been like afterward, when that feeling disappeared. In April, the country will mark the 20th anniversary of the massacre at Columbine High, and that day will arrive in the aftermath of the worst year of school shootings in modern American history. Last spring, the Washington Post launched a database that tracked incidents of gun violence on campuses dating back to 1999, and the carnage in 2018 shattered every record. Most shootings at schools, 25. Most people shot, 94. Most people killed, 33. Most students exposed to gunfire on their campuses, 25,332. Nonetheless, school shootings remain relatively rare, even after a year of historic carnage on K-12 campuses. What's not rare are lockdowns, which have become a hallmark of American education and a byproduct of this country's inability to curb its gun violence epidemic. Lockdowns save lives during real attacks, but even when there is no gunman stalking the hallways, the procedures can inflict immense psychological damage on children convinced that they're in danger. And the number of kids who have experienced these ordeals is extraordinary. More than 4.1 million students endured at least one lockdown in the 2017-18 school year alone, according to a first-of-its-kind analysis by the Washington Post that included a review of 20,000 news stories and data from school districts in 31 of the country's largest cities. The number of students affected eclipsed the populations of Maine, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Vermont combined. But the total figure is likely much higher because many school districts, including in Detroit and Chicago, do not track lockdowns, and hundreds never make the news, particularly when they happen at urban schools attended primarily by children of color. Still, on a typical day last school year, at least 16 campuses locked down, 9 of them because of gun violence or the threat of it. The Post's final tally of lockdowns exceeded 6,200. The sudden order to hunker down can overwhelm students who have wept and soiled themselves and written farewell messages to family members and wills explaining what should be done with their bicycles and PlayStations. The terror can feel especially acute right after school shootings like the one in Parkland, Florida, when kids are inundated with details from massacres that had taken the lives of students just like them. In New York City earlier this year, rumors of a firearm on campus sparked panic at a Staten Island high school, where teens desperately texted and called their parents, begging for help, telling them, "I love you." In Fremont, Nebraska, students sobbed as they hid for nearly 2 hours in a girl's locker room with the lights turned off after a teenager was spotted with a gun. When armed officers barged in, they ordered the kids to put their hands up. In Pensacola, Florida, a sixth grader messaged his grandmother, certain a shooter was in the building after social media threats triggered a lockdown. "Please check me out before I do," he wrote her, then corrected his misspelling. "Die." And then there are the kids like Mackenzie, who have never heard of Parkland or Sandy Hook or Columbine, but have heard the sound of gunshots on the streets where they live and play and learn. She cherishes few things more than school. All of Mackenzie's classes are her favorite, except for language arts, her favorite. The girl can read well beyond her grade level and has nearly memorized the story "Monsters Don't Scuba Dive," said her mother, Gabrielle Woody, who works in an aftercare program at DC Prep. Mackenzie didn't stop loving school because of the lockdown, but she did think about them often, about how upsetting it was that they had interrupted her time to learn new words and different ways to add up numbers, about how scared she'd felt when some of the kids wouldn't stop making noise and how her teacher had offered them Smarties if they could just stay quiet for a little longer. She'd also become wary of recess on the playground, where games of tag and climbs across the monkey bars had once been among the highlights of her days, until the lockdowns happened, McKenzie said. I don't want to be outside, because what if someone was shooting and we had to leave and we were too late and everybody got hurt? No district is exempt from the fallout of lockdowns, regardless of demographics or affluence, location or security. School systems in every state and the District of Columbia had several last school year, the Post analysis found, and they happened in buildings with as few as 4 students and as many as 5,000. While various threats, sometimes referencing bombs, accounted for 15% of lockdowns, and police manhunts near campuses made up a similar share, at least 61% of lockdowns were related to firearms. Although most kids won't suffer long-term consequences, experts who specialize in childhood trauma suspect that a meaningful percentage will. John Kachowski, a former teacher and naval officer who heads a security for a 40,000-student district near San Diego, uses an analogy to help people understand the purpose and impact of a lockdown. It's like an airbag, he said, because they save drivers' lives in car crashes. But the devices might also break noses and crack teeth. Last school year, the system Kajowski oversees, Sweetwater Union High School District, dealt with 71 student threats, he said. But only 7 times did the schools lock down. And 5 of those were prompted by off-campus danger, such as a burglary or gunfire. In 11 instances, schools went into what they refer to as secure campus mode, in which classroom and exterior doors are locked and no one enters or leaves the buildings, but teachers can continue with instruction. Some school districts still categorize that or other similar measures as lockdowns, while others call them lockouts, building mode, or sheltering in place. Though those scenarios can also unnerve children, the experiences are usually less jarring than turning the lights off and hiding in the corner. Still, because there are no universally accepted best practices, schools take dramatically different and sometimes haphazard approaches to preparing students. Earlier this month at Lake Brantley High in Florida, an unannounced active shooter drill induced pandemonium across the 2,700-student campus, leaving mothers and fathers furious and their kids contending with nightmares. People were crying and texting their parents goodbye and having asthma attacks, said Kathy Kennedy Payne, head of the National Association of School Psychologists Crisis Response Team. To do that to children, I think that's unconscionable. Kennedy Payne and other experts agree that drilling is essential, both to protect students from physical injury and to ease the stress of going through a real-life emergency. But the drills must be done with care. To illustrate the harm that a lockdown can do, Francie Crippeau-Hobson, a psychologist, pointed to a pair of schools she worked with in recent years. In December 2013, a teenager killed a fellow senior at Colorado's Arapahoe High before taking his own life. As Crippeau-Hobson and her colleagues on the state's crisis response team treated students and staff in the aftermath, they found a school well-prepared to care for teens struggling with grief and fear. Not long after, Crippeau-Hobson was asked to help students from another high school outside Denver. In that case, an off-campus robbery and carjacking left 2 people shot, but no violence ever reached school grounds. They were on lockdown for hours and hours without any information to alleviate their dread, Crippeau-Hobson recalled. Afterwards, she said the school did little to ensure that its students felt okay, though many didn't. Teens suffered from stomach pain and headaches. Some struggled to focus in class. Others couldn't sleep. It was like, wow, this was what we see after a school shooting, she said. They looked very much like kids we've seen from other major crises. compounding the problem for educators, according to the Post analysis. A leading cause of lockdowns, threats, and a common effect, anxiety, are contagious, and they're each exacerbated by actual gun violence. Nationally, the 7 days with the highest number of incidents leading to school lockdowns occurred in the 2 weeks after the bloodshed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High in Broward County, Florida, on February 15th. It's not just mass killings, though, that leave children believing they might get shot in their classrooms. As Anjani Dartguanabe told Road to School in Charlotte, North Carolina, with his mom one morning in October, he heard on the radio that a student at Butler High, about 20 miles away, had been gunned down in a hallway. Anjani, 12, didn't say anything about it at the time, recalled his mother, Claudia Charles, and she didn't discuss it with him. They live in an upscale neighborhood where crime is rare. He had never seen a gun in person or heard shots from his bedroom, and Charles, a nurse, wouldn't even let him play with water pistols. Not once did she imagine that the violence they'd heard about on the radio would make him feel unsafe. 11 days later, Anjani was studying English literature at Governor's Village STEM Academy when the intercom announced that the campus was being locked down. The seventh grader didn't know that an anonymous threat, never in danger of being carried out, had elicited the response. He knew only that a boy in the community had been shot to death inside another school a week before, and that made Anjani think he would get shot too. As he and his friend sat on the floor, Anjani reached into his book bag, adorned with a smiling cartoon anime character. Without making a sound, he pulled out a pencil, writing first on an index card and then a sheet of notebook paper. At the top, he scribbled his home address and his mom's name. "I am sorry for anything I have done," he wrote. "I am scared to death. I will miss you. I hope that you are going to be okay with me gone." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And we'll read a couple of the articles on the health and science page this week. China's pioneering moon mission. China has become the first country to land a spacecraft on the far side of the moon, setting the stage for a new space race with the U.S. The unmanned Chang'e 4 probe, the name was inspired by an ancient Chinese moon goddess, touched down last week in the South Pole, Aitken Basin, an ancient impact crater that's about 1,550 miles in diameter, 7.5 miles deep. Landing on the moon's far side is incredibly challenging because the moon's body blocks direct radio communication with a probe. China first had to put a relay satellite in orbit above the moon in a spot where it could transmit signals to the craft and to Earth. The far side of the moon is of particular interest to scientists because it is heavily pockmarked with deep craters, more so than the familiar near side. Chinese researchers hope to use instruments onboard Chang'e 4 and its lunar rover to find and study areas of the South Pole Aitken Basin where the mantle, the region below the crust, might be exposed. This really excites lunar scientist Carl Peters, a planetary scientist at Brown University, tells NBC.com, because it means we have the opportunity to obtain information about the interior of the moon and how it's constructed. Data about the moon's composition, such as how much ice and other exploitable resources it contains, could help China decide whether its plans for a future lunar base are feasible. And the health scare of the week is titled Medication and Depression. Your medicine cabinet could be making you blue. More than one-third of Americans are now taking medications that can cause depression as a side effect, according to a new study. Researchers identified about 200 prescription drugs that can cause the mood disorder, including many common medications taken by older adults, such as proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, used to treat acid reflux, and beta blockers for hypertension. The study found that the more of these drugs people take, the greater their risk of depression. About 7% of participants taking one such drug were depressed, compared with 15.3% of those taking three or more. Many doctors may not be aware that several commonly prescribed medications are associated with an increased risk of this disorder. Study author Mark Olfson, a professor at Columbia University Irvine Medical Center, tells Consumer Reports. But other experts note that many people taking these medications already suffer from conditions that put them at a raised risk of depression. Up to half of people with chronic pain, for example, also have depression or another mood disorder because the parts of the brain that process pain also affect mood. And just time for a short note or two. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg missed Supreme Court oral arguments this week for the first time since she was appointed in 1993. The 85-year-old justice is still recuperating from surgery after two cancerous growths were removed from her left lung in December. A single 603-pound bluefin tuna sold for a record $3.1 million in an auction at Tokyo's fish market, bought by the owner of a sushi restaurant chain. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote from Johnny Cash. He says, "Success is having to worry about every damn thing in the world except money." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.